Welcome to the Dauntless Grace Exchange. I'm Deidre.
And I'm Megan. And we have another Megan joining us today on the podcast, Megan Reedy. And Megan, I'm going to let you introduce yourself after. You introduce yourself after I read your bio. My prepositions are going to be out of order here, but I can do this. It's not too late and past my bedtime to record a conversation, right?
It is past your bedtime. You're like That's an true. Old grandma.
I know.
The sun is still brightly shining, folks, in case you're wondering.
I was just going to say, with the summer and the sun, doesn't that help?
No, guys, I went to a Matchbox 20 concert, and I was very, very clearly up past my bedtime. It didn't start till 9 o'clock. Who goes places when the event starts at 9?
Not old people in their 40s.
Not Gen Xers who are watching their band on stage who are clearly in their 50s.
I'm a millennial and I still want to, I'm gone. So.
All right. So Megan, millennial Megan, Megan Reedy is the clinical director of Eden's Glory, a restoration program for adult survivors of human trafficking. She is also the founder of their minors program, Foster Kairos, that provides outpatient therapy and caregiver support for kids who have been trafficked or are at risk. Megan is a licensed clinical social worker and practices several therapy modalities, including internal family systems, as well as brain spotting, a new therapy designed to help people process trauma using their visual field. Megan is the wife of Philip, mom of Amelia, Emmy, right?
Yep.
Coffee lover, beach enthusiast, and an Enneagram 3. She believes that God provides real and deep healing and is overjoyed at the opportunity to play a part in his plan in the lives of women and children that she serves. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm so excited you're here. Tell our listeners a little bit more about you that's maybe not in your official bio.
Yeah. I grew up in the South and moved to Illinois about 4 years ago to work for Eden's Glory. And my very first day here, met my husband. He swooped me up, showed me around town, and that was that. So...
I haven't heard that story. How did you meet him?
Yeah. So I met him when I came up to interview for Eden's Glory. He was the admissions counselor for my younger brother, who was interviewing for Greenville at that time. We kind of just saw each other and we're like, oh, they're kind of cute. Okay. And my mom, embarrassing, was like, oh, my daughter's moving up here. Can we get your contact information to talk about places to live? And so I got his contact info from my mom and emailed him.
That's amazing.
Your mom is like matchmaking. I love it.
Yes, she is. So when I came up, he reached out and was like, hey, I'd love to show you around. And so my first day there, he picked me up and showed me the Greenville sites, which for those of you not
45 minutes.
Is, yeah, if that. He ended up taking me to Vandalia just to add some stuff in. And yeah, just that was that. So we got engaged a year later, got married, and now I have a little girl. And yeah.
She's so cute. She's like the cutest. Oh my goodness.
She is. I agree.
Her foot's always in her mouth when you're like on a Zoom call or something. It's so cute.
Always. She loves her feet and she's always moving.
Tell us a little bit about what led you to pursue therapy and counseling. Like what was the path for you to get to that point of decision in your life?
Yeah. So I learned about human trafficking when I was a teenager. My dad's a pastor and we had a missions moment at church and they showed a video on human trafficking. And I just, in that moment, felt the Lord say, this is what I want you to work against. And so knew I wanted to work in the anti-trafficking field, but had no idea what I wanted to do. And so went to college and just kind of started with psychology because that seemed a good base point. And then took some brain classes and realized that is not my strong suit. So I switched over to sociology, which has a lot less brain stuff. But you can't do anything with a bachelor's in sociology.
Right.
So that led me to kind of just asking around, trying to figure out from different people what to do. And I heard social work has the most options. It doesn't kind of narrow you down like some of the other marriage and family therapy, counseling, that kind of stuff does. So decided to go that route. While I was there doing my practicum, I got assigned to work with kids who had experienced trauma. And I went to my advisor and said, I do not want to work with kids. I said, that's not what I want to do. I have no desire for that. I want to work with women. And she told me, this is probably the closest you're going to get to working with trafficking survivors. And so I encourage you to just try it. And I loved it. So I didn't think I wanted to do therapy either, but I loved that also. So I got hired at Eden's Glory and was like, okay, I guess I am going back to adults. Came up here, started working, and about a year in, Ginger and Annie, who have been on the podcast before, are the founders. They pulled me aside and said, we want to start something with minors. Would you be willing to take that and run with it? And I said, absolutely. And that's kind of where Foster Kairos came from.
Yeah. And that is, it's free counseling service to minors who they've either experienced trafficking or are vulnerable to it, right?
Yep. And so a lot of times people can ask what being at risk or vulnerable to trafficking looks like. And so in a lot of situations, that's going to be kids who have experienced extensive trauma or abuse in their life, kids who are in foster care, kids who have a tendency to run away from home, have unstable home environments, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's good.
Do you work with all ages or are they primarily like teenagers?
I work with ages 5 to 17.
Wow.
Yep. So I got some littles and I got some teenagers, and it's very different with the different ages, obviously, but I didn't quite know what I was getting myself into widening that age range so big.
Which one do you think is easier? Because I could see reasons on both sides that pros and cons to both, I guess.
Yeah. Funny enough, I like the preteens the best. Which I didn't think that I would, because, you know, a lot of people really struggle with that age range, but they are old enough to understand the concepts I'm trying to teach them, but they're not so old that they think that it's uncool to try the coping skills and to share their feelings and that kinds of stuff. So 12, 13, that's the fun age.
That's exactly why I was a middle school teacher, and I used to explain it that way. Like, they're old enough that you don't have to hold their hand all the time, but they're young enough to not think school's not fun.
Absolutely.
But then I parented a preteen, and that was absolutely the hardest age to parent so far. And I'm up to teenagehood so far, and preteens is the hardest.
And you're like, now I understand what all those people questioning me were saying.
And you're like, you're such a saint. You work with middle school. I'm like, they're the best. And then I'm like, oh, it's because I hadn't parented one before.
Right. Now I see it.
I had a different experience. I was a youth leader and I did not like dealing with the middle schoolers. They drove me crazy. They were just so, you know, immature. But in a classroom environment later, when I got to actually work with kids in a K-12, I liked the like fifth and sixth graders the best, because they really did. They, just like you said, they like still thought school could be fun. And even if they'd had some negative experiences, it wasn't too late to kind of change their mind. So yeah, I totally agree in that environment. Yeah, interesting. Okay. So why we have you on the podcast, or I should say while we have you on the podcast, we want to talk a little bit of Enneagram. It's not really the focus of today, but of course, you know, it is in your bio. You're an Enneagram 3. So tell us a little bit about your journey, learning about it, coming to the conclusion that you were dominant in as a type 3, and just some of those clues that you found to help you figure that out.
Yeah. I love talking Enneagram. You can ask my husband. I do way too much. He hosted a marriage retreat a couple weeks ago, and I kept telling him, you need to bring in a couple to talk about the Enneagram. And I pitched you guys. And he was like, I want a married couple, and not everyone knows the Enneagram, and you know, all that. And so he brought a couple in, and then they started talking about the Enneagram. I'm like, yes.
It's such a great starting point, like, for understanding each other and having a language around it. I tell my kids, don't even think about getting married to someone without me making you sit down and do this first.
Yeah, I don't know how you have any marriage seminar or retreat without understanding that, honestly. But what's Phil's Enneagram number?
He's a 2 with a very heavy one wing. We went back and forth from a 1 and 2 forever, but yeah, finally landed on a 2.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So tell us about discovering that you were a 3.
Yeah. So I actually learned about the Enneagram from you guys. You came and trained our staff. What was that? 4 years ago? 3
yeah,
years?
Yeah. 4 and a half maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was my first time really hearing about it or learning anything about it. You went through all the numbers, and I was leaning towards either a 3 or a 5. And Megan, I was talking to you afterwards, and I told you that. And I remember you telling me no one has ever struggled between a 3 and a 5.
My bad.
And I said, well, I don't know what to tell you.
That's funny. I've learned some tact since then, if that helps.
Also, we were fairly new teaching it then, so the fact that we're like, no one in our very long history of teaching this has ever struggled that.
It's because I have never met an extroverted 5, and I very rarely met an introverted 3, although I have since then met some
Yeah.
introverted 3s. And so the energy dynamic is so different between the 3s and the 5s that I had interacted with up to that point, that I was like, I don't know how you're confused between these two things.
Yeah.
Now that I have met some introverted 3s, I can see where that energy isn't going to look the same, although I still haven't met any extroverted 5s.
Yeah, I haven't either. But yeah, so that's where I got stuck with the energy, because all of the core woundings, the messages, the comparison, all of that really stood out. And but I was just, I don't have this unlimited bounds of energy. And I do feel like I have a limited amount that I kind of have to portion out throughout my day. And but the more I just kind of sat with it. I can't remember. One of you told me to just spend some time thinking that you're a 3, and then spend some time thinking that you're a 5, and see which one fits better. And very much felt like the 3 fit better, and that the 5, my main thing was just the energy. And so I came to realize that kind of what you guys said, you can be an introverted 3. And I think, well, I know that's where I've landed. I have a pretty strong 4 wing, and so I think that plays into it as well. From stuff that I've looked at, a lot of times the 3 wing 2 can be more of the out in front of everybody, wants to be the center of attention kind of 3, whereas the 3 wing 4 can be more of like the professional, wants to get things done, wants to be seen well at their work. And so kind of identifying more with that one is where I've landed.
Your subtype could also play into that, like introversion and the energy and stuff. So I don't know if you've done any subtype work to know which one you are, but it's possible that that could be a huge explanation that we were very unaware of 4 years ago when we did that training. So
I actually think you and I read through those, and there was one that did
we
talk about
did.
like the professionalism versus like, because sometimes those handles that we put on like 3s are the performers or 3s are the whatever, they don't fit for all of the subtypes as well, yeah, so that makes sense.
Yeah, I definitely lean more towards the achiever than the performer. I struggle with that title. But yeah, actually, Deidre and I went to a work conference, what, a month or two ago, and we read through all the subtypes together. And I really thought that I was going to be either self-preservation or one-to-one. And I wouldn't even look at social because I said, I'm an introvert, I'm not social. That one doesn't even apply to me. And Deidre was like, let's just look at all of them, let's just read through them. And that was the one that fit. Weirdly enough. And she
That's not weird though, because the introverted 3 that we know is also a social subtype.
really, yeah, I think it's just weirdly named because you hear social and you think that it's going to be the extroverted 3. And so, yeah.
I think social and sexual are both strange, but it's like I don't know what else you would call them, but they just self-preservation makes a lot of sense because of how it's defined. The other two, you have to read like what they're defining that to be because the label itself is a little weird.
It's almost like they were just trying to come up with a good alliteration that they could then explain later.
That's exactly what I was going to say. They wanted 3 S's.
3 S's. There we go. Now make it work. Okay. I love that. Yeah, it's so nuanced, and the more you get into it, it's like, oh, this is why, and oh, then that makes more sense, and yeah, just drawing all those lines and comparisons. Well, I do want to get a little more into the topic of trauma. So, could you just, as someone who deals with this, teaches on it, actually works with people with trauma, could you give us a good working definition to work with, or to talk about?
Yeah. So the way that I tend to identify trauma is as a deeply distressing or disturbing event that causes impact in somebody's life. And so there can be the kind of traumas that we automatically think of, abuse, divorce, neglect, that kind of stuff. But then there's also the other traumas like being bullied at school or some type of natural disaster, car accident, that kind of stuff.
How do you define like kind of the difference though? I guess something we all do in my family, the girls will come home and be like, "Oh my gosh, I still have PTSD from that." I'm like, "Well, do you really? It's probably not PTSD, but I think it's they're having a response to like a little T trauma, right? They are having a response to whatever's happening in the moment that's recalling something in the past that was difficult and they distressing maybe at some level. Where do we draw the line here, and like, what does that look like as we actually talk about it in the day to day?
Yeah, I think you're phrasing little T trauma and big T trauma. I use that a lot with my kids as well that I do therapy with, to help them understand that little T traumas are those things that are really going to happen to most people in our lives. They can definitely still be distressing, but they aren't causing a lot of times long-term negative consequences in our lives. Big T traumas are going to be those things that are actually impacting our mental health. They can be impacting us emotionally, physically as well. And we're going to see those effects long term and not just in the immediate.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So, could little T traumas, though, cause long-term effects if they just are so consistently experienced over time? Like maybe there's never one big traumatic event, but the little T's just add up, add up, add up with no tools or coping mechanisms or healing processes, could that cause then that same kind of mental health distress later on?
I think you hit on it with if you don't
Okay.
have the coping skills, and if you don't have really, you don't have the support. If you don't have those people that can come around you and help you process through it and heal from it, then yeah, it definitely can.
Because I'm thinking some of those things like persistent, like maybe a parental, not that it's abuse or neglect, but it's not a healthy. Their own coping mechanisms life maybe aren't healthy, and so it's those little persistent things that you experience over a long amount of time. But I guess the difference is if you are able to persist and find some coping mechanisms, you're not like crippled by that as in the same way.
Yep. And I would say little T traumas put you at risk for big T traumas in your life. Obviously not the natural disaster kinds, but looking towards what we work with our ladies, human trafficking, sexual assault, abuse, domestic violence, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It brings to mind what we talk about with Enneagram Sevens a lot, how they don't learn how to cope with little disappointments along the way because they're always reframing the negatives in their life. And so when a big thing happens that they can't reframe, now all of a sudden it is, whether it's a real, it usually is a big T trauma or something, they have no support, no tools, no nothing because they've never learned how to deal with it. And it kind of sounds like unless we have the support and tools needed with the little T traumas our whole life, then we're either at risk, like you said, for those big T traumas, or they end up causing that distress later on anyway. So in one sense, we're all at risk, whether we've experienced some life-shattering events or not, right? Okay.
And I would say even the little T traumas can put you at risk for things like self-harm, which could cause a big T trauma in your own life, and not necessarily something that's coming from somebody else, but still has that impact on you.
I feel
That
like
makes
a lot
sense.
of people deal with things like maybe anxiety or depression at a level where it's not impairing their function in the world, but it probably is from more like a persistent little T trauma. I'm just curious, what are some of the ways that we can think about that in our own lives, like how we can cope with some of the mental health that we are just struggling with on the day to day that sometimes can be worse or better depending on the seasons in our life? Do you have any recommendations just for our average listener that might be going, what can I take away from this?
I mean, I would want to us all to be aware of how mental health is playing out with the circumstances that are happening in our lives and in other people's lives. And so when you add on the layers of little T traumas that are happening in everybody's lives, you add on the big T traumas that are happening in some people's lives, you add on the mental health that's happening in a lot of people's lives. There's a lot going on beneath the surface that we're not seeing. And a lot of that is impacting the ways that we are interacting with each other, the stories that we're bringing with us into situations and circumstances, the lens and viewpoint that we have. And so wanting to be aware of that with ourselves, but also wanting to be aware of that everybody else has that too, and they're coming in with that also.
I think the more Somebody said to me the other day, if you've never experienced God's grace, it's really hard to give it to somebody else. We were talking about forgiveness, and that was kind of like their thoughts on it. And I was like, it is true. The more you've experienced, like knowing what you are healing from and knowing how deep it is in your own interpersonal story, it's actually easier than to give that kind of grace to somebody else, because you're like, if this if I'm this complicated, I'm this much of a mess, like they're going through their own stuff too, and then we're all trying to like communicate that way. But it just feels like it should just provide so much more empathy and compassion toward others. Like if the inner work we're doing doesn't have that result, then we may be doing the wrong inner work. Like it
Absolutely.
makes us love better because we have to learn to love ourselves, you know, like these two things, like, well, we talk about that on here sometimes. Sometimes Christians are opposed to self-help, like we get what we get from God. Well, yes, but he said love others even as you love yourself, but we don't love ourselves well when we don't even know like what is going on and how deep some of that work is, the grace that we need to give ourselves for healing and everything. But that's a tangent, sorry.
And I mean, that's why the Lord helped, us learn about things like mental health and gave us counselors and therapists and that kind of stuff, because our brains are complicated. And I mean, the Lord made us that way, but he wants to give us these tools to help work through them. And we don't want to say, stand firmly on just, yes, absolutely, the Lord heals, but sometimes he's going to use other avenues, and we want to be willing to use those avenues that he's equipped in the same way that we would use, doctors and cold medicine and all that kind of stuff.
Why do we put it in a different category for some reason?
Well, here's my tangent. I was talking with some people of a different generation, and I definitely won't name names, my dad, but because he won't ever listen to this. But they were talking, I don't even remember what about, but it kind of became like, oh, everybody has traumas. Everybody has traumas. Everybody's so soft these days. Just walk it off, basically, was the gist of the conversation. And I was like, how'd that work out for your generation to not know anything about that for yourselves? And I feel like there's just a lot that kind of resistance. It's not even like sequestered to one generation. Like, I know plenty of people in that generation who have totally understood and applied these principles in their own lives. But what would you say to people who are like, oh, we're just too soft now? We want to diagnose everything, and we want to tell everybody it's a trauma and that we need therapy, and everybody has a therapist. And what would you say to that?
I would say that I think in a lot of ways it's a great thing and it's progress. I mean, when we first started seeing doctors, I'm sure that there was some people that were like, oh, not everybody needs to go to the doctor right after you're born, and you don't need to do yearly checkups, and you don't need your own pediatrician. But I mean, we've come to realize, yeah, we do. We all need those things. And so I think having more of an awareness of mental health and making it more normalized is super important. Because it's not just the severely mentally ill, as people like to phrase it, that need the help. It is all of us who's been through everything in our lives, big T traumas, little T traumas, the annoyances we're trying to live with, just verbally processing to somebody. I mean,
It's true. I think mental health, like we all have mental health. It's what spectrum of health or unhealth is that on some days, or in seasons, or in a diagnosable condition, or whatever that is. But we all have mental health, just like we all have physical health that when it's failing, we need looked at. So I like the way that you said that. Like, it's about all of us then at that point, and not whether or not we've taken it too far as a generation to go get everything diagnosed. I don't know. Sorry.
like having good language around it. It's like when people say, I have a temperature, I want to be kind of a jerk and be like, well, I hope so. Like you should have some temperature. Is it elevated, like a fever, or what's going on? So yeah, we all have mental health. This is something that it's something, I think, what is it, the zeitgeist, like in 20 years or in our kids' lifetime, it will be such a natural thing. It'll be like for us to understand, you wash your hands after you go to the bathroom, or you don't eat food that's not
Although,
fermented.
to be clear, we weren't really taught that until 2020, apparently, because that's when all of a sudden people were putting hand washing videos out like that hadn't been a thing.
Right. Right. That's true.
Well, bad example.
In general, we understood the concept of germs, at which 200 years ago, they didn't have the same kind of, you know, general populist understanding of that. And I feel like that we're going in the right direction. Like you said, it's good progress that it's more mainstream, that we're talking about it more, because our grandkids are going to have healthier mental health because they will just understand some things that previous generations just didn't talk about, didn't know to talk about. It'll just be so different. And to go back to kind of what I was joking about before we got on the call about a comment my dad had made, he was adopted in an era in the 40s when you didn't have open adoptions. You didn't really even tell anybody if you didn't have to. Like, it was very different than by the time my sister and I were adopting, and best practices around that were just so different, you know? Mm-hmm. And we know that even since our adoptions just, you know, 15, 16 years ago, we're even further down the line of what best practice looks like in that. And so to be resistant to better practices in ways, in things that will make us healthy and a more whole society is just crazy to me. Like, why are we not open to that?
Maybe we shouldn't use the word crazy then, Deidre. Maybe we should remove that from the zeitgeist.
You're so right. I just had to do that with someone recently. They were talking about themselves. I was like, no, let's take that out of our vocabulary because you were doing what you needed to do at the moment.
I will say one soapbox that I do get on that kind of adds to this, but also goes against it in a little bit of ways, is I think we absolutely need to be more aware of mental health, but I also think we need to be careful that we don't normalize it too much, because it bothers me when everybody claims to have anxiety or everybody claims to have depression, mm-hmm. when it really is something that needs to be clinically diagnosed and you need to be able to get the help that you need from it, rather than just normalizing it too much to where mm-hmm. when people actually have it, they don't know what to do with it because they think that it's something that everybody has. Or, you know, the big things out nowadays is how, if you disagree with me, you're gaslighting me, or
you're a narcissist.
Narcissism. Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
And so I think we've made a lot of progress, but I do want to warn us to be careful to not take it too far to where we actually lose the context of what these things are, because we're trying to normalize it into society too much. So that's just a side note, but
and it's again a kind of a vocabulary thing, because we can have feelings of anxiety or even a day that we feel depressed, and it is different than, like you're saying, like a clinical situation where you need more assistance in that and it's more persistent, ongoing. It's like describing what love is. Like, I love ice cream and I love my husband. These are very different kinds of. I'm trying to say, are they different kinds of love? They are different. Some Depends days on the day. One more than the other, but we won't bring that up right now.
Yeah, I think it's a difference between saying I feel anxious about this versus I have anxiety. Mm-hmm. I think that in itself is the difference. Or like, oh, I have OCD about this. I mean, PTSD. We throw these acronyms around I mean, I do it. I'm terrible at it with especially PTSD, but throwing those around all the time when really we're watering it down. So it's not that we don't want to normalize it. So we don't want to water it, I think, in such a way that makes it then inaccessible to the people who need the supports for it the most.
Yeah, that was a great way of putting it. Yeah,
that's good. Because otherwise, people who really are being crippled by something in a way that is causing them an inability to like function, they're probably thinking, well, if everybody's got it, then what's wrong with me that I don't have the coping, you know, skills mm-hmm. myself to deal with, when it's not the same thing. Like, we're not talking about the same thing. So yeah, I think that's a really good point for us to remember.
Yeah. And that's another reason why I like the distinction between little T traumas and big T traumas also. It's because if we call all these things trauma, then it can be really hard for someone who's had a very severe big T trauma and someone else who's had a small T trauma, and they're trying to compare it and say it's the same thing because it's both trauma. Again, you can get into a hard place.
Yeah.
It's wow, I'm about to say something that's going to get me in trouble with a lot of people, but I know they're changing the language around autism right now in talking about, and this is a little bit off tangent, I think, but they're changing the language. Instead of it being like high functioning, low functioning, now it's high support. Is that the right word? And low support? Like if you need a lot of support, if you're autistic and you need a lot of supports, it's what we used to call low functioning autism. but now it's just high support. And so they're kind of changing it. And I like that change, although I think it's going to take people a long time to get used to it. But I think that is a good way of talking about like things like depression, anxiety, traumas, of going, we all need support for trauma, little t, big T, no matter what we've experienced, even if it's just, like you said, verbally processing the irritations throughout our day, we've got to have supports around it. But some of us need high supports and professional supports to get through some of the stuff that we've experienced. Yeah. And some people can do it without the professional supports and maybe some smaller supports and lower supports.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. A lot of times people can say, why do I need to go to therapy? I can just, you know, vomit to my friend and I can verbally process to my friend. And that can be great if it is the little T traumas kind of things. If you are someone who needs low support, you just need someone to verbally process to. But if you do need someone to provide some sort of intervention or to help you come up with a game plan or to give you new coping skills, then those are the situations where, yeah, you're going to need more high support. And those are situations for counselors, therapists, those things can really come in handy.
Yeah. So to kind of wrap this up, and maybe I'm stepping on whatever your next question was, Deidre, but what, as those of us who aren't trained counselors, I know you both have been in school for a long time to get different certifications and degrees, but I did not for that. So those of us who aren't trained counselors and therapists, like what can we do just in interacting with people that we know have experienced big T or little T traumas that have affected them in some way? Like, what are some things to do, things to not do, just in kind of a nutshell?
Yeah. I mean, one of my biggest things that I always want to encourage people is just be willing to apologize. If you say something and someone ends up taking offense, just be willing to say, I'm sorry, I'll do it differently next time. Because there's going to be, there's going to be some people that you can joke around with and you can say, oh, I have PTSD about this and it's perfectly fine. And there's some people that would take that not great and say, you don't know what you're talking about. And so just being willing to say, you're right, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have joked about that. I think it's just a great starting point. I'm sure you guys have seen it. There's a picture out there of this big circle, and then inside the big circle is a tiny circle. And in that tiny circle, it's labeled what you know about somebody's life. And then the big circle is what's happened in their life. And so that's something I always like to hold going into relationships, conversations with people of, I don't know what they've been through. Even people that I know well, there's still stuff that they may have not processed with me. There's still the lens that they have, viewpoints they have from the way that they were raised. And so I want to be sensitive to what's happened in their life that I might not know about. And so I can't walk on eggshells like some people claim that we are trying to do. But I can be willing to think about someone else's opinion, think about the way that it's affecting them. And then if I mess up, to say, sorry, I'll try to do better next time.
I think if we all could walk around with a little bit more compassion and awareness and willing to own our own stuff, I think it would just all be easier. All the world would be easier.
It's so true. We get defensive first. Like, well, I didn't mean, I didn't want, I didn't, you didn't understand how I said it. Instead of just, I'm sorry, you know, really easy to say. It's not though. It's hard. It makes us vulnerable, but you're right. It's just, it brings everybody's defenses down. I was thinking about the book, What Happened to You, like saying that instead of what's wrong with you, you know, like, why are you being like that? Why are you like that? Making all of these kind of accusatory assumptions about people instead of like, you're saying, oh, well, there's like 98% of that person that I don't know, you know, about their story. And maybe that's influencing how they're responding to me in this moment. And I could give a little grace and compassion toward that. It's so good.
Yeah, because I get stuck on that a lot with the kids that I see, the women that I work with. People look at them and see, you know, a lot of the women as prostitutes or homeless or drug addicts. They look at the kids that I work with and see them as, you know, runaways and troublemakers. But they don't know what these people have been through in their lives. They don't know the situations that they're trying to survive. And so if I see that every day with the work that I'm doing and the way that it impacts these kids and these women that I work with, like, then I absolutely want to take that out into the world with people that, yeah, maybe they haven't been trafficked, but they got their own stuff going on. And I see this every day with our women. So I want to make sure that I'm using that viewpoint out and about as well. And just encouraging other people to do that too.
So
That's
good.
so good. Well, thank you for sharing that. I hope people can just take that nugget away and let's just walk with more compassion and empathy and understanding. We would be a whole lot better as Christians for that. Our witness in the world would be a much brighter one, but also just be a healthier space to live in with each other. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your time and you do. Megan was saying you guys have been studying. No, you have been studying for a long time. I am like on your coattails, just learning a little bit, but
No.
we appreciate you
No.
like just sharing so much wisdom and yeah, it's good stuff. And what you do is really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I was excited to get to come on. I drive to St. Louis once a week to go see some kiddos there, and I listen to Dauntless Grace every time I travel. So when Deidre, just in passing at our conference a few months ago, said, "Say you want to be on our podcast?" I was, "Yes, absolutely." You might be kidding and saying that in passing, but yes,
Yay, no, we're so
I
glad.
do. Well, come back sometime because I'm sure I could talk more trauma stuff all the time. So.
So could I.
I think we should do a double date with you and your sister-in-law, Kennedy, and Megan and I. I think that would be a fun episode.
Oh, yeah.
We'll find some fun topic, but I haven't talked to her in a while, so that would be good.
It will be. We're an 8 and a 3, so we're fun together.
And a 1 and a 4, I don't think I would get a word in.
I was just gonna say, we actually did a marriage thing last year, the only few times we've had a guys on, and one of the couples was an 8 and a 3, and they talked about their spicy dynamic.
Spicy dynamic. I
Yeah.
like it.
Was great.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys.
And that wraps up another episode of the Dauntless Grace Exchange. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave a review so other people can find us.
You can follow us on social media to stay connected. We're on Instagram at Dauntless Grace Ministries, and our Facebook page is Dauntless Grace.
For more about the Enneagram, visit our website at dauntlessgrace.org for coaching and training opportunities. And you can follow me at Enneagram Megan on Instagram.
And be sure to check out our website for more information about today's podcast. Plus, you can click the resources tab to find books by all the authors we've spoken to or about. And you can find it at dauntlessgrace.org.